This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
Dr. Johanna Fernandez met many missions, and she fought her battles with brilliance and grace.
Dr. Johanna Fernandez, Dominican-American historian, prison abolitionist, movement scholar, and a voice at WBAI Pacifica Radio, has died at age 55.
Louisiana has the second highest number of ICE detainees. We have 8,000 ICE detainees here. Only Texas has more, not a lot more, and Texas has a much more populous state.
New Orleans activists denounce ICE concentration camps and attacks on immigrants in Louisiana.
Every year, the United States gives Israel enormous amounts of military aid. Lately, some in Congress have started to object to that aid. That's not something that AIPAC wants. It does not want any debate about that. If they can institutionalize, routinize the delivery of American military aid by integrating it legally into the Israeli military, then they won't have to talk. The issue won't be raised every year that Israel does not want raised, which is, should the United States be funding the Israeli government or not?
Ian Lustig, co-author of Israel's Lobby, America in the Grip of a Foreign Power, on the integration of the U.S. and Israeli military-industrial complex. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Dr. Johanna Fernandez, the Dominican-American historian, prison abolitionist, movement scholar, and a voice on Pacifica Radio, died July 30, 2026, after a years-long struggle with cancer. She was 55. Johanna's primary political work for many years was as an active organizer and strategist with the campaign to free political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. We share Mumia's commentary from prison, honoring her and her life's work.
Dr. Johanna Fernandez, PhD, presente. As I remember first meeting her, when I was on death row, it becomes difficult to proceed. For this piece is one of the hardest things I've ever done. She was teaching at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh when a labor historian friend named Dave Demarest invited her to death row in nearby Greene County. When she accepted that invitation and walked into the death row visiting room, it was like a dark, dismal sight struck by a sunburst. Dr. Johanna Fernandez had arrived, shining with brilliance, beauty, intelligence, wit, and power. She grew up with three brothers. And like all brothers, they fought each other frequently, just like I did with my brothers. Guess who could cool them out? Johanna could. That youthful toughness made her stronger and allowed her to fight and struggle so well as an adult. That, in advice from her mentor, Dr. Manning Marable of Columbia, who gave her the words of Dr. Frantz Fanon from his masterpiece, The Wretched of the Earth, quote, "Each generation must discover its mission, fulfill it, or betray it in relative opacity." unquote. Dr. Johanna Fernandez met many missions, and she fought her battles with brilliance and grace. As she had been mentored, she mentored other younger scholars in how to walk and work in those two worlds of academia and activism. So every day, she put on her uniform, a black blazer and black slacks, her armor, and marched on to the struggles of this world. She touched movements all around this world, in France, in England, in Puerto Rico, and beyond. She, sadly, so very young, has left us, but her brilliance and her presence will never, ever be forgotten by any of us. Our beloved sister, Dr. Johanna Fernandez, at the young age of 55, joins the embrace of the ancestors with love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal on the life and work of scholar, college professor, author, and activist Johanna Fernandez.
Rock stars. South Bronx. Can't get enough. Shy City, Santiago, worldwide. Here we go now, look. Now I ain't did no bids yet, but it's time to take some action. They locking us up, not giving a up, cause they got us all distracted. Ain't learned shit in my classes, so I'm reading some of this Malcolm. They follow my moves all week on Twitter, so this is a tweet I'ma reconsider. Our deck be X-Main, Hunts Point off the express train. We marching, protesting, we rising, so let me explain. We under attack, so we gotta fight back, so don't think that I'm stressing. It's raining, oppression, so I'm training, no question. Mutulu, Sunni Ada, I'm screaming hands off Asada. Why bother? Cause I'm a problem, and you won't see me get called up. They know where I've been, who I live with. Police be thinking I'm a bad boy, cause I'm rocking at the Rock, guarding the Bronx, so please turn up that sound, boys.
It's time to free Mamiya, we gotta bring him home. Freedom for Oscar Lopez, that everybody know. The people gotta show me, we screaming now for show.
That was Rebel Diaz, Free 'em All. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. Louisiana has become a major center of the Trump administration's ICE detention system and its attacks on immigrants. More than 8,000 people are being held in detention camps across the state. In New Orleans, activists have been rallying throughout the city to protest the raids and detention of immigrants. They spoke with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about what is happening in New Orleans and across Louisiana.
Maybe you can talk about why you're here today. What's your name?
My name is Tom Reardon.
And what's going on here?
Well, we gather here every Wednesday and just kind of register our protest for all of the, you know, harassing of immigrants, voting suppression, war. It's a long list, but we come every Wednesday and there's always plenty to protest.
And the issue of redistricting, what does that mean for the people of New Orleans and Louisiana?
It's horrible. They, in the middle of an election, they first of all canceled everyone who had already voted, redrew the maps, made the candidates who were challenging the Republicans recollect signatures again to qualify for their new districts. The voters don't know what's going on. It's just a big suppression play, and they eliminated what probably they're trying to eliminate the black congresspeople from the state. I was up in Baton Rouge at the hearing with a bunch of people, and I got to tell you, the chairman of that committee and the guy who proposed the legislation were so ashamed of themselves they couldn't even look up and look anyone in the eye, but they did it anyway.
Are you worried about going back to segregation?
Yes. I mean, it's happening. And it's horrible for everybody. It's horrible for black, it's horrible for white, it's horrible for the whole country. And that seems to be on the agenda, so we just have to fight.
How many times have you been out here?
This Wednesday pop-up? Maybe 30 now. And
people keep coming out.
Oh yeah, there's a different pop-up, at least one every day of the week in a different site around the city. But we're the Wednesday one here, you know. And this is I don't drive. This is the one I can walk to. So
we're still here. We haven't quit since a year ago, I guess, was when we started, probably April, May of last year. And we're out here every Wednesday, just as the other groups are at their locations every day of the week without fail. And you can see we're still having fun and promoting our messages, and we're starting to shift towards voting awareness. So we'll be putting emphasis on that from now on every week.
My name is Sunny Moon, and I moved back to New Orleans after being away for 30 years. I grew up here. I moved here from New York City, where I was very involved, and I've thrown myself into volunteering here.
And what's going on here in Louisiana and New Orleans with the elections and redistricting and the whole situation?
So I don't even know where to begin, but what I want to convey is that I actually have hope. With all the terrible news, I think that people are finally motivated in a way so that they can see that there's a path that's different from where we have felt like we had no choices. So despite the fact that there's lots of terrible things, look around us. I'm meeting lots of people who are volunteering for the first time to helping elect better candidates.
And they've removed people from office. They're redistricting in the middle of elections. So, how has that affected people? I mean, what is going on?
So I've been canvassing for Lauren Jewett, who is running for the seat against Steve Scalise. So a lot of the people that I've been talking to are people who've been redistricted. And let me tell you, the people who got moved from having Cory Carter, who is the Democratic candidate, to now having Steve Scalise, are furious. And they are motivated in a way to vote in a way that they didn't have. They weren't so motivated when they were like, it's a done deal, we're going to get Cory Carter, who's the Democratic voter. The fact that they throw out all these early votes is so shameful. And I'm not, you know, it's something that we don't talk about, but people voted and they threw out those votes and they won't even say whether they'll ever be counted. Like, to me, the fact that they did that, number one, and the fact that it's not bigger news, is really shameful. I mean, we're talking about the most basic right to vote, and that's being discarded.
You think there's a threat of fascism in this country?
I think there already is fascism. I've been arrested twice in the last year, and
what were you arrested for?
So the first time I was arrested, I'm a physician, and I was at an ICE protest, but not participating in any civil disobedience. But I noticed that there was somebody that had three cops on top of him, and he wasn't moving. And I yelled out that I'm a doctor, and I thought that they were going to kill the person. And they got up, and they pushed me, and then I was arrested. The second time I was arrested.
What were the charges?
A blocking a federal driveway and impeding with the arrest of somebody.
Even though you did not interfere?
I was on the sidewalk and I wasn't even close. There was actually videos of me getting arrested because there were people there videotaping it because it was so appalling.
And ICE, what is their role here?
So I'm an immigrant. I became a U.S. citizen, and one of the reasons why I left New York City, which is very blue, is that even in New York City, I didn't feel safe. I live in the neighborhood where the federal court, where the federal immigration court, where they have the most courthouse arrests have been happening. That's where I became a U.S. citizen, and that building is in my neighborhood. And I volunteered as a court observer, and I witnessed people being ripped away from their children.
What does it feel like to see that kind of?
So my background in healthcare is I'm a palliative care physician. I was a hospice medical director. I've seen some things that you wouldn't believe because I took care of people who are dying. The emotional trauma that I witnessed was similar to when I took care of young patients who were dying untimely deaths. This is so egregious. These are men wearing masks and sunglasses. I talked to a family from Russia who was seeking political asylum when I was volunteering, and they said, even in Russia, this doesn't happen.
And at the same time, the Medicare cutbacks, how is that affecting people here in Louisiana?
Again, I'm a physician who took care of older people. Again, it's insane. Every civilized, every similar, economically similar country in the world has health care for everybody. We have the bare minimum, and they want to take that away. Like, a lot of people don't know that their Medicare Part D supplement is going to go away. Do you know how hard we fought to get that? Because that didn't even exist.
This whole private control of healthcare.
Yeah, it disgusts me. So now that I haven't practiced in a few years, but I'm going to go back. I love being a doctor, but being a doctor isn't about taking care of patients anymore. And that's...
I mean, you're working for the insurance company. You have to get approval from the insurance company. You have to spend all your time trying to get approval for patients.
So luckily, I chose never to do private practice. I always did academic medicine or not-for-profit hospice. But when I start practicing, I will work in a federally qualified healthcare clinic. I will never go into private practice because I won't see 40 patients in a day.
Do you think people are waking up in this country?
I hope so. Otherwise, they're going to wake up and it'll be too late. They'll wake up at some point. It's a matter of whether they wake up before when they can make a difference versus waking up when it's too late.
I'm Mike Howells with Stand Up for Democracy, Louisiana 8-8, part of the August, also Socialist Arise, then the August 8th National Action Coalition. The main purpose of this was to give people an outlet for their opposition to Trump, the drift toward, and the general drift towards authoritarianism in this country. You know, with Trump every week, something new comes up.
Are you worried about fascism?
Pardon?
Are you worried about fascism in this country?
Well, yeah, I mean, we've definitely got a Bonapartist as president, so that's certainly a big step in that direction. Certainly, you know, the authoritarian element's getting stronger and stronger and stronger. It's one of the things we protest against, and we do that all the time. ICE came down here, and they had what was called Catahoula Crunch. That was the name of their operation. They had alligator head chomping on something. Anyways, well, they came here, and it turned out there aren't that many immigrants living in New Orleans. They all live in the suburbs. And so they shifted gear and they went out to Jefferson Parish, where a lot of the immigrants live. And then for some reason, you know, there was opposition. But then for some reason, they just packed up. Where did they go? They went to Minneapolis. So I guess our benefit was getting rid of ICE, but it was Minneapolis's curse.
There are these transfer centers here in Louisiana. What's going on with those?
The big one is up in Alexandria, Louisiana, which is in the northern part of the state. And that's what Trump is developing or turning into kind of ground zero for the deportation of immigrants from the United States. And we have people up there who are opposed to that, you know, in that community, Alexandria. We want to keep in touch with them. And so there's resistance. Now, also, Louisiana has the second highest number of ICE detainees. We have 8,000 ICE detainees here. Only Texas has more, not a lot more. And Texas has a much more populous state. And they concentrate all the ICE detention centers in the northern part of the state in the rural areas, so there are not a lot of people. There's a reason they don't have it near New Orleans.
And they're profiting these companies, GeoCorps.
They're making money. Same one. Oh, I'm sure they're making hand over fist. They get to open a new place every other week, it seems. But they were here even before Trump came. But now I guess this is the base, you know, for the national base to really just, we're Siberia, okay, or where they send ICE detainees.
No one knows how many people are there. They can't get in. They're like prisoners.
They can't get in. I mean, I was there when Mahmoud Khalil was down here, well, really up there for us. He was in a city called Jenna. I'd been there before for a protest like 10 years before over police brutality. And no, we couldn't go in the center and talk to anybody. But we did go out there. We had about 50 of us. We were protesting, demanding that not only he, but everybody in the detention center be freed. It was, you know, the fact that he was there, we used his celebrity, I guess you could call it, as an opportunity to drum up people to go. Because that's a long ride. It's like 200 miles from here. And it was a successful action. They may not have heard of it there, but in Louisiana they know about it. And if really, if you want to fight Trump's war on immigrants, well, we've, the ones who are in, detained, this is the place.
And August 8th, what happened on August 8th?
August 8th was when there was the National Day of Action in solidarity with the immigrants, with the refugees, with the political prisoners, and the ICE detainees. And we had an action here in New Orleans. It was part of Louisiana 8-8. And we had about 70 people in a park downtown, Lafayette Square Park. And we had a good turnout. We had a broad group of people, some from the suburbs, some from here, people from various political organizations. We had the National Nurses Union show up. They're building their union.
Yeah, it's very difficult to have unions as a open shop state.
Right, right. Well, you know, as far as healthcare unions, for a long time, the biggest one was at Charity Hospital, big charity in downtown. But then with Katrina, the Democratic governor who promised to defend charity, Kathleen Blanco, used Katrina as a pretext to set up a new hospital, which is just horrible. University Medical Center, I mean, I'll go there if it's an emergency. But the whole regime is different, and that's why, because they want one that's more profit-oriented. And part of depopulating New Orleans in this area, or at least getting the working class, poor people out after Katrina, was eliminating the public services. And one of the most important public services that they eliminated was de facto public hospital charity, which was, you know, a blessing for the people there. They also eliminated public housing and privatized education, which had
Arne Duncan, who was Obama's Secretary of Education, was kind of gleeful as an opportunity. He saw the hurricane as an opportunity to bring in charter schools.
There were a lot of them like that. Yeah, I remember Arne Duncan. That bastard can go to hell. He wasn't alone. I'll tell you how bad it was. The Republicans were better than the Democrats on public services. That's pretty pathetic. Like, for instance, we were running around asking, I was in the public housing movement, and we had focused, because we existed around Iberville Development. So we'd had protests right after the city opened up. And the first project that the mayor definitely wanted knocked down was Iberville, because it was close to the projects. And then the head of Alonzo Thomas, the head of HUD, said, "You're not hanging that on us." And so only because the Bush administration didn't want bad publicity, that's the one housing project we got reopened. And you know who had it closed for good? Obama. When Bush left 4 years later, Obama came. He had, you know, he had it basically the Hope Six. And then with charity, it was even worse, because we had a movement, we were fighting for the reopen of charity. Public support was overwhelming, because this was a hospital that was definitely the most largest, but also the most working class oriented, most affordable in probably the country, but certainly in Louisiana. And so what happens? We have Katrina, Governor Kathy Blanco, who again ran on defend charity, closed Charity Hospital. When the National Guard boss came in and said, "All right, Charity's ready to roll. Tulane Hospital across the street's already open. You can open up Charity too." The Governor Blanco said, "We have other plans for Charity." And they didn't open up another hospital for 10 years.
Those were the voices of activists in New Orleans who are fighting the ICE concentration camps that hold over 8,000 across Louisiana.
Well, Trump was elected, his voters were ecstatic. When agents poured into the cities, it was cinematic. Closing down the borders, they said, "Just you wait. Getting rid of the immigrants will make the country great." In spite of the tariffs and all those deported, the economy was tanking instead of being sorted. Then came the visit from a close ally who came to D.C. with a plan for the president to try. When the whole plot went from bad to worst, written by Israel first. People are wondering that despite the fact that they'll all be called anti-Semites, how it is such a small place can have the impact it's got, how it seems to have the power to call the shots in the USA. A movement grew, make America great again. Only a few people understood who controlled the operation, how the Epstein class ran the nation. When the whole plot went from bad to worst, written by Israel first.
That was David Rovix, performed by AI Tsuno. Israel first. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasilyev. Ian Lustig is the co-author of Israel's Lobby, America in the Grip of a Foreign Power, a new book about the role of the U.S. in Israel and the merger of U.S. and Israeli foreign policy and military industries. He spoke with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Pacifica. I'm joined by an author, Ian Lustig. He is the co-author of a book, The Israel Lobby, with Eli Clifton, who's a journalist. Ian is a University of Pennsylvania retired professor emeritus, and was with the Carter administration and the Council on Foreign Relations. Why don't you talk, Ian, about why you wrote this book and what the purpose of writing the book was?
Well, wrote the book we decided to write the book after the Gaza war had erupted, or the onslaught on Gaza. And we really thought that there were truths that the American people need to know that they really didn't know. And we also wrote it because an excellent book on the topic of Israel's Lobby appeared in 2007, written by professors Mearsheimer and Walt. But in the 20 years or so that have gone by since, the world has changed enormously and the lobby has changed. And we wanted to explain not only how the lobby was interfering and compromising with American national interests abroad, which is something that scholars such as Mearsheimer and Walt had documented even earlier, but how the lobby in its current incarnation and under current conditions is threatening American freedoms as well.
And you talk about how the lobby works and the change of lobbying in the United States. How has the change in the laws under the Supreme Court changed lobbies like the lobby that supports Israel?
Well, instead of thinking so much immediately about how the lobby has changed, let's talk about how the world has changed in three basic ways that makes the existence of this Israel lobby much more dangerous and makes its behavior more desperate. One change is that the world shifted from decades of bipolar rivalry between the United States and the Soviet Union, that made foreign policy kind of simple. We were out to contain the Soviet Union, and the world made sense around that. And most, if not all, Americans agreed with that position. That meant that if the Israel lobby was pressing a president too hard, under circumstances where the president could say that the Soviet Union was a bigger threat and had to be met, even though it was inconvenient for Israel, that presidents could face down the lobby. And once that threat was gone, once the Cold War ended and the United States first became the unipolar power in the world, and then became part of a messy, predatory, multipolar world, it was not possible to invoke that standard rivalry with the Soviet Union to discipline the lobby. Another problem is that in the decades of the 50s, 60s, 70s, Israel was more or less a moderate state. And the principle that the lobby demanded, which was no daylight between the United States and Israel, wasn't that expensive for America to abide by. But as Israel has become more and more extreme, the cost to the United States of not allowing daylight between us and whatever an Israeli government wants or does has become extremely high. And finally, as you alluded to, the American electoral laws changed, the electoral financing laws changed. The Supreme Court took away most of the guardrails, allowing essentially unlimited money by the ultra-wealthy class to flood into the political campaigns. And this has made given to a small group of quite right-wing Israel-first lobbyists, donors, an enormous amount of influence, and it has unmoored the lobby from the grassroots opinions of its supporters, including many American Jews who no longer align themselves with what the lobby has argued for, since the lobby is aligned with the Netanyahu government, the most extreme government in Israel's history.
Well, one of the roles that the United States has played in the Middle East is direct intervention in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And I know in the case of Iraq, there was a committee to liberate Iraq, George Shultz. And the role of Israel was to support that war with Iraq through lobbying and saying that Iraq was a threat to the United States. That lobbying, I mean, it seems has shaped people's views and the government's view about why it is intervening in these countries in the Middle East.
Well, that's correct. The Israel lobby, people associated with the Likud, with the right wing in Israel, who were prominent in the lobby in the late 1990s and early aughts, were crucial in the process that led the United States into the greatest foreign policy blunder made in this century, which was the invasion of Iraq. Several very high-ranking people in the administration were involved with the Likud government, with Netanyahu directly, and they had in front of them not only ambitions to make the United States some kind of new global imperial power, but to do it in a way that would support the expansionist ambitions of Israel. That we see that again in a different way with this Iran war, with Netanyahu, the prime minister, who has been urging successive presidents for decades to make war on Iran, finally found a president incompetent and gullible enough to follow his urgings. Netanyahu has met privately with Trump, more than many more times than any other leader in the world since Trump assumed office the second time. He specifically met with Trump shortly before the attack on Iran, and reports that emerged after that meeting showed that they together planned that war. We also know that even Trump's close advisors at the top of the heap there, including Vice President Vance and his intelligence chiefs, thought the ideas that Netanyahu was pushing on Trump were farcical or imaginary, that they could never overthrow the regime in the way that Netanyahu was saying would happen. But it was Trump who decided to pull the trigger.
The decline of the United States internationally, it can no longer compete economically with China. Isn't this increasing the kind of adventurism of the United States? I mean, it seems that going into this war with Iran is actually accelerating the decline of the United States economically and internationally.
I'm not ready to say that we can't compete with China. In certain areas, the Chinese are clearly outcompeting us. And for the most part, that's because we back away from policies that would be obviously beneficial for us if we had a smart government and one that was focused on the things it ought to be focused on and not how to remodel the White House or outfit a new airplane. But I do think that the wars that we're plunging into, including this Iran war, is an enormous drag on our economy. We don't see China involved in these needless foreign wars. They have their own financial difficulties, but they don't have these kinds of massive self-inflicted wounds that these wars represent. And one reason why we keep doing this, why we have Vietnam and then Iraq and now Iran, is because we have so much more military power than the rest of the world combined that a president, any president, whether it's Ford or Obama or Trump, sees in the use of that military a temptation that's hard to resist, because advisors will say there's a problem out there and you will be blamed for not solving it, because you could solve it if you were more of a hero and ready to use the military force that you have. And presidents find themselves often frustrated. They can't do much domestically because the American system ties them in knots. So they tend to go abroad to do things that are dramatic. And that's why It's important, if we're going to have a restrained, responsible foreign policy that avoids these needless wars, to reduce the margin of superiority that our armed forces have over the rest of the world.
And in your book, you talk about the effort of the lobby to label people who are critical of Israel as anti-Semitic. They passed rules that say if you criticize Israel, you're anti-Semitic, and embedding that into the legal system. Were you accused of being anti-Semitic for writing this book?
The book is not quite out. It'll be out next week. And I've said that if I am not accused of anti-Semitism, it will be a disconfirmation of the argument. I'm Jewish, so is Eli. I've been called anti-Semitic and Nazi for decades. Originally, I was called that back in the 70s and 80s because I favored a two-state solution. Oh, that's a Nazi position, I was told. You are a self-hating Jew because you're for a new... Now, more recently, I've realized that a two-state solution is impossible because Israel has integrated the West Bank into the state. We need to really base a solution eventually on equality for all who live between the river and the sea. Well, now I'm called an anti-Semite because I reject the two-state solution. So I'm doomed in that way. But all kidding aside, and I'm not kidding, what we show in the book is the systematic use of accusations of anti-Semitism that are almost wholly made up in order to further the objective of supporting Israel without having to defend its policies. That's absolutely crucial. One of the things we do in the book is trace the use of different manuals that Israel and Israel advocates have developed over the decades to help their propagandists debate critics of Israel. And we show over the years how those manuals have changed from substantive engagement, defending Israeli policies based on values that the audience can be expected to share, to a realization that no arguments can actually be won in front of American audiences if you're trying to defend Israeli policies. They're so extreme. So instead, the manuals tell people, don't try to engage your audience, spin things, distract them, or call their arguments anti-Semitic, or call them anti-Semites. This is right. This is the strategy that's used across the board. Now, one of the problems is, and I acknowledge this, and we acknowledge this in the book, that there is anti-Semitism in the United States. It's a real problem, and it's rising mainly because a state that operates itself in the name of the Jewish people is doing such horrible things that it helps anti-Semites increase the number of people who sympathize with their views. This is not something the Israel lobby wants to hear, but it's the truth. It's not October 7th that produced increases in anti-Semitic sentiments. It's October 8th. It's the barbarous overreaction, the killing of 72,000 Palestinians, and all the essentially destruction of Gazan society. It's the wave of terrorist attacks by settlers against defenseless Palestinians in the West Bank. It's the displacement of 800,000 people in Lebanon by the wholesale bombing and razing of civilian areas in Lebanon. These are the things that are producing the dangerous threats of anti-Semitism that we're seeing.
Well, of course, as you know, this would not be possible with the United States support, U.S. military and economic support to Israel. And I wanted to also talk about, you talk about Pollard and the fact that he was released. And also, I mean, the role of Israeli agents in these organizations, the lobbying organizations. I know the ADL had a case where they had an agent who was not only spying for Israel, but spying for the South Africans, the apartheid regime. And the whole question is, they're basically foreign agents, but they're not held accountable by registering as a foreign agent organization.
Right, they haven't been registered. We portray the lobby not as operated by Israel, but as guided by Israel and by whatever the current Israeli government tends to want. But one of the points, and you just made the point that Israel couldn't be doing what it's doing without American aid. But we make the further point that Israel wouldn't be the right-wing pariah state that it is had the United States not showered it with unconditional aid for decades. And that would not have happened had the lobby not been so successful. Now, one of the tragic things is that the people who were involved in the American lobby to support Israel never really wanted, most of them never really wanted Israel to become what it has become. They just wanted Israel not to be pressured by the United States. But the fact that Israel wouldn't be pressured by the United States changed Israeli policies. It wasn't the intent of the early lobby, but it had the effect of removing the ability of moderate Israeli politicians to win Israeli elections. Only they kept saying, we can't keep the West Bank, treat the Palestinians as irrelevant, rely purely on military force, settle everywhere we want, and expect the United States to continue to support us. And the left that made that argument was always wrong. The right said, no, we can do whatever we want, and the United States will still give us what we need, protect us at the UN, and give us a qualitative edge and support our nuclear monopoly in the Middle East. And they were right. And that meant that over time, only increasingly right-wing politicians who would pander to the fantasies and fears of Israelis, they're the ones who kept winning elections. So it's not as if we only make Israel's actions possible. We actually, the United States, unintendedly helped produce the Israel that we have today. It's not the Israel we could have had the lobby not been as strong as it was.
But doesn't it have to be tied up with what's happening in the United States with U.S. capitalism and can't compete? And it's the rise of fascism in not just in the United States, but internationally. Isn't that part of the whole economic crisis that capitalists are facing? I mean, the rise of fascism in Europe. I mean, immigrants being migrants leaving Iraq, leaving Syria, going to Germany, going to Austria, and then fascists blaming the immigrants for the crisis, you know, using that those wars and the migration as a justification to have fascist policies.
Well, look, these are the largest issues that are facing liberal Democrats all over the world. And there's no question that the struggle that a minority of Israelis who are struggling to bring some form of liberal democracy back to Israel, they are fighting the same fight that we in the United States and those in Europe who are struggling to against populist authoritarianism. It's the same struggle all over the world. And the economic distress that is felt by working classes throughout these countries as a result of the way globalization was carried forward and the pressures of migration, yes, all these things are connected. But let's point to but one of the ways in which they are connected is that they foster a belief in emotions and not problem solving. And they're looking for, and that means that people who get elected are out to blame people who are supposedly responsible and not the structural conditions that are giving rise to the suffering of the masses. And once you start a political once you introduce into a political arena the decisiveness of mobilizing prejudice and bias and fear instead of solving problems, you are turning the situation over to dangerous fascist impulses. Yes.
And I mean, the issue of, is the United States controlled by Israel? I mean, your book says that they have a lot of influence and that they mold the debate, and they have people who are agents who have worked for these organizations, who are agents of Israel or helping Israel get information. But you don't believe that the United States is controlled by Israel, do you?
No, I do not. And I don't believe in many of the wacky conspiracy theories that suggest that. One of the things that we do in the book is go back to George Washington. George Washington, in his farewell address, which before the Gettysburg Address was the most honored political speech in American history, warned that the American political system is organized in such a way that every group, every faction has its own self-interest, and those factions don't agree on what they want. They fight it out among themselves, but because there are so many, they cancel each other out. And the United States is therefore protected against doing really stupid things because the can't unite on anything that's really stupid. He said, the problem is this won't apply in foreign affairs. If, he said, there's a faction or a minority that has an extreme affection for or a passionate attachment to a foreign country, or even a passionate animosity to a foreign country, they will have outsized influence on the government unless there's an agreement that the United States is not going to get over-involved abroad and that politics stops at the ocean line. He warned that minorities with a passionate attachment to another country would disrupt American policy, lead us into needless wars. Now, he had in mind Jeffersonian attachments to the French during the French Revolutionary period. But his warning was for all time, and it wasn't just about the French. And the Israel case proves that Washington was absolutely right. We were doing pretty well as long as we had a consensus on containment and on what American foreign policy would be abroad that didn't allow, that didn't encourage polarized Democrats versus Republicans on foreign policy issues. But, and most Americans just didn't care much and don't care much about foreign policy. But when you have one group that cares more about a foreign policy issue than anything else, and it's extremely well resourced, that group, as Washington predicted, can have an enormous and destructive effect on American policy. And now we are seeing that it can have a destructive effect on American politics because of the way money and the demand that free speech be limited, freedom of assembly be limited. Look what happened on the college campuses. It's even gotten to the point where the lobby is not settling for just saying there are certain people who are anti-Semites that should be deported or not allowed to speak. The institutions that produce those people, the elite institutions, the universities, the press, entertainment industry, those are institutions that should be controlled as well, because otherwise they'll produce people critical of the current Israeli government. It's extraordinary how much ambition the lobby has to try to control and prevent debate in the United States.
One of the bills that is in Congress now is to integrate the U.S. and Israeli military and intelligence agencies.
Yes.
What would the effect of that be?
That's something that actually Eli and I wrote an article about that recently in the Guardian. It is another example of how the lobby is trying to institutionalize American support for the Israeli government without having to defend its policies. Every year, the United States gives Israel enormous amounts of military aid. Lately, some in Congress have started to object to that aid, and you have debates about whether it's wise or not. That's not something that AIPAC wants. It does not want any debate about that. If they can institutionalize, routinize the delivery of American military aid by integrating it legally into the Israeli military through the sharing of knowledge, through technical partnerships and a variety of other techniques, then they won't have to talk. The issue won't be raised every year that Israel does not want raised, which is should the United States be funding the Israeli government or not. So that's a great example. And I was very interested to see that it wasn't so easy for AIPAC to get this through Congress. They did succeed in doing it. What this shows us is that the political class will be late to the party. The grassroots of America is shifting. Public opinion and results in primary elections show that Israel is not an issue which candidates win on. They lose on it now. But the political class, those in power, they still have been sucking at the tit of the lobby for decades. They can't give that up so fast. Think of the NRA, okay? The NRA, even though Americans want serious gun control laws on assault rifles, on locking guns up when they're not in use, they don't get these. Why? Because the politicians themselves are enthralled to the NRA. That's the future. That's the what the Israel lobby is becoming much more like the NRA. It has to operate behind the scenes, holding on to the throats of the politicians to keep their policies intact. They can't rely on public opinion or on some general idea that this is the right thing to do.
But isn't the military-industrial complex, which Israel is part of, not only Israel, in your book you mentioned that the ADL is involved in defense funds, JLENS, that there's an integration in the military-industrial complex between the United States and Israel militarily, and that these lobbying organizations are actually benefiting financially by investments in military-industrial organizations.
Well, I mean, that's true. I don't believe that that's the determining factor, but it is, but certainly when we look at and Israel makes this argument, it makes the argument that its aid, billions of dollars that goes to the Israeli military, actually is good for the United States because it gives profits and jobs to the large military contractors. That's a main argument that Israel makes. And certainly that does create a wider network of people supportive of continuing this. Israel also does have a terrific record of inventing innovative military and intelligence techniques that are used by the United States. So it's not a partnership that's all one way. Israel definitely contributes quite a bit. But what we see now with the burying of this inside the defense budget, instead of making it something that has to be discussed every year, we see that, I see that as a symptom of the larger crisis faced by the lobby, that it cannot defend Israeli policies in the marketplace of ideas in the United States.
And the one question I had about the book, The Lobby, is there's no mention of the role of the AFL-CIO, which has been a stalwart supporter of Israel. A Golda Meir statue was in the headquarters of the AFL-CIO. Since the formation of Israel, they've been not only backing Israel, but opposing any dissent among trade unionists, workers, that this relationship of Israel to the United States was harmful, and the conditions of Palestinian workers was something that had to be addressed. I mean, the slave-like conditions and the really attack on any kind of worker and democratic rights for Palestinian workers in the region.
Well, you're right. We don't really talk about the AFL-CIO's relationship with the Israel lobby or with Israel, which was most prominent in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and we're much more focused on recent decades. And it would take some more work to determine to what extent there's been change within, if not the AFL-CIO itself, many unions. There are signs among unionists in the United States of frustration with Israeli policies. There's some acts of solidarity that the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement has, Palestinian movement has found among union members in the United States. I myself have been contacted by union members. I don't think that relationship is as strong as it used to be. But I'd also point this out, and we do go into this in the book. Americans are familiar with the idea of a blue state, a purple state, and a red state. Well, the AFL-CIO, when it was in bed with the Labor Party governments in Israel, saw Israel as a blue state. It was like Rhode Island or Connecticut. And in some ways, it was a social democracy for Jews, at least. And the Labor Party was in strong control. In fact, the Labor Party was in control of every government until 1977 in Israel. But after 1977, when the Likud came to power for the first time, Israel became a purple state. It became like, we can say, Ohio or Pennsylvania. But actually, now Israel is not a purple state. It has for decades been Idaho. It has been Oklahoma. It's a deeply red state, and that makes the relationship between AFL-CIO or unions and Israeli government much different than it used to be.
That was Ian Lustig, co-author of Israel's Lobby, America in the Grip of a Foreign Power, talking about the integration of the U.S. and Israeli military-industrial complex. He spoke with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates that contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Seltzer, Ann Garrison, Thomas O'Rourke, and myself, Paulina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. We've updated our website, so make sure you're subscribed. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.